I am faithfully drawn to the drowning abyss. I live contentedly, if uneasily, in the land of limbo.
Welcome to this special Cambridge Forum featuring internationally beloved author and illustrator Maurice Sendak. For more than 40 years, Maurice Sendak has led children and adults to explore the limits of their world, taking them from the night kitchen to where the wild things are. The occasion is the 2003 Mayhill Arbuthnot Honor Lecture, awarded by the Association for Library Service to Children, a division of the American Library Association. Hosted by the Cambridge Public Library and Children's Literature New England in collaboration with MIT, Mr. Sendak reflects on his life in children's literature and leads us on a descent into limbo. Here now is Maurice Sendak.
There are many varieties of limbo, and the 20th century provided us with an abundant sampling. Yes, my generation inherited the legacy of the all-annihilating bomb, a reality so unreal we were left wandering in that drear limbo. But then there are the personal limbos, the fumbles and false starts of an artist coming of age in a world of uncertainties. How to focus the shapeless creative self. Being young helps you keep the rude world at bay. Denial, in a word, is a snap. Let me tell you something about how I struggled to liberate myself from a limbo I faced in mid-career, how I turned all my life efforts towards the only thing that made any sense to me, the deepening of my work as an artist. Such a paradox. Here I was having what most people would consider a very successful career. Even I did. But I realized that, as my dear Jenny would have said, there must be more to life than having everything. In 1978, I turned 50, and for reasons I've already set forth, I was looking for a new job, something beyond the pleasures of publishing books and splendid isolation and postponed gratification. As far as my creative life is concerned, I have always been lucky. An opera director I much admired, Frank Corsaro, called me out of the blue and invited me to design a new production of Mozart's Magic Flute that he was going to direct. I told him of my deep love of that opera, indeed of everything Mozart. I also told him of my complete ignorance of the business of stage and costume design. He knew my books and trusted me and promised to surround me with experienced craftsmen who would teach me all matters technical. I had been thrown a life preserver. Since I was 16 or so, Mozart has been my savior. And the Magic Flute is my favorite of all his perfect operas. It has everything I wish my own work had a scrap of. Beauty of shape and design, a comic, low-down vaudeville vitality blended with dark, serious truth-telling, depth of soul, and a generous, unjudgmental view of humankind. What touches the heart so deeply is Mozart's fundamental goodness, the Menschheit he yearned for. After my initial flutter of pride and happiness at the prospect of designing the Magic Flute, I slowly slid into despair. How so late in life could I commit myself to a whole new discipline? In truth, music was and is my first passion. I cannot live or work without it. I have no musical talent whatsoever, except for my ability to whistle on pitch. And from memory, a goodly chunk of the classical repertory. Perhaps not so strangely, only my German shepherds have been loyal listeners. Designing, costuming, and sitting through rehearsals would be an extraordinary reward for a life of Mozart idolatry. However, as deadlines approached, living and working inside an opera was a dream come true that turned into a nightmare. Thus, the creative process, which is indistinguishable from depression. The symptoms are weirdly similar: falling off of appetite, dry mouth, lethargy, contrasting rage, and a manic frenzy to hang on the telephone and wail wantonly to friends who have mostly given up on me and can barely disguise their pleasure at my misery. They've all been there before. Finally, I was face to face with a big bad question. Who do I steal from? And where do I go to steal it? For those surprised by such confession, let me quote one of my great hero geniuses, William Blake, from whom I have stolen copiously. An answer to the statement, quote, how incapable those are of producing anything of their own who have spent much of their time in making finished copies, is well known to all who are conversant with this art. To this, William Blake barked back. This is most false. For no one can ever design till he has learned the language of art by making many finished copies, both of nature and art, and of whatever comes in his way from earliest childhood. The difference between a bad artist and a good one is, the bad artist seems to copy a great deal. The good one really does copy a great deal. Thus spake my master. Sometime in the late 70s, a brief article in the New York Times caught my attention. It was titled, A Montaigne Masterpiece at the Met. It spoke of the rare opportunity to see Christ's descent into limbo by the Italian Renaissance master Andrea Montaigne. The painting was on brief loan to the Metropolitan Museum from the private collection of Barbara Johnson. There lies another tale, but later. To continue from the New York Times, roughly 15 by 16 inches, the work depicts Christ's liberation of the prophets from limbo. Jesus, his back to the viewer, leans forward on his staff towards the opening of limbo's cave. Four figures, Adam and Eve among them, languish at his left. A single elderly male figure hunches to Christ's right. And at the mouth of the cave, a prophet reaches up in a pose that mixes anguish with desire. Montaigne has imagined a violent gust of wind blowing out from the stony entranceway. Christ's robes and the garment covering the prophet billow suddenly forward. Unquote. This I realized pretty quickly. This was the entirety of the Magic Flute in one gulp. And here is how I saw the painting, how it affected me. The thunder and shock of, imagine all of you, the back wall of this very room suddenly falling away, collapsing, and only a choking limbo gaping forth. A violent, stinking wind swirls out of the pit. Christ is stunned. His hair and robes blast back, and his stiffened shoulder blades betray fear. This is the only Christ I know who is seen from the back. We can only guess at his expression. His blowing robes reveal his form in such a way as to make him very human and very vulnerable. He will, despite himself, dive into limbo and save the despairing prophet. The Montaigne painting is a perfect metaphor for the incoherence of the creative act. For the artist's perilous dive into the interior of the self, the descent into limbo. It is a sublime image to steal from, a vision of exceptional theatricality. Its narrow stage has been turned over entirely to the scene's players who boldly crowd the panel's edges. My magic flute would open onto a yawning cave entrance with rough stone steps heading down to the stage floor. Almost immediately, our hero, Tamino, enters, chased by a monster. He faints and tumbles down the rough steps. He is a young man having his first mature adventure, and it almost proves too much for him. In the very next scene, our heroine, Pamina, in her own cave-like setting, comes rushing on stage, chased by a rapist. She falls into a faint. Two inexperienced youngsters overcome by their confrontation with the new and incomprehensible. I think of these two scenes as two exquisite 18th century cameos, enlightened kids taking their first steps, an awakening into sexual awareness and confusion. The Magic Flute is a vaudeville magic show meant purely to entertain, but just below the luminous surface is a rather dark tale about the difficulties of exploring and surviving. These kids have unwittingly dived into their not-so-fairy tale lives. There are also three little boys in the opera called either genies or spirits, or in the original German, Knaben. They guide the hero and heroine as best they can. They are the only characters in the opera who do not lie or exaggerate. At a crucial point, Pamina, in terrible confusion and pain, attempts suicide. The boys stop her and convince her that she is indeed loved. She instantly brightens and believes. Why would children lie? It is this trust and faith in the child that breaks my heart. The music Mozart gave the boys is simply unearthly. It is the sound of the purity of childhood. In the end, Pamina, the frantic and confused girl of Act One, by comprehending and believing the three boys and truly loving Tamino, moves quickly ahead of our hero. She has more than earned her place in the Mozartian paradise. And with her gentle strength, she leads the young man by the hand. Pamina triumphs. Together, Pamina and Tamino find their way through a series of subterranean caves and finally to a brilliantly lit inner sanctum where they are wed in a Masonic ritual. I've used the word dive a great deal today. I'm borrowing it from a favorite comment made by Herman Melville, yet another deity in my personal constellation of gods. In a letter written on March 3rd, 1849, he said, "I love all men who dive. Any fish can swim near the surface, but it takes a great whale to go downstairs 5 miles or more." In his correspondence, Melville frequently refers to the theme of diving deep, of committing oneself to extreme goals in order to avoid mediocrity. Emily Dickinson, another of my deities, wrote several poems about pearls found only by the deepest divers. And John Keats was in love with the idea of diving deep for the rarest fish. But how my heroes would have scorned me. I can't dive, and I can't swim. Nevertheless, when it comes to struggling with my deep sea fancies and fashioning them into picture books, I am a heroic diver, a regular Greg Louganis. I am faithfully drawn to the drowning abyss. I live contentedly, if uneasily, in the land of limbo. That I chose to live and work in the world of children's books when I grew up is clearly no mystery. I am obsessed with childhood and no good for anything else. Limbo suggests chaos, and chaos denotes childhood. And childhood is the armature of all my work. Maynard Solomon, in his biography of Mozart, finds in his music, quote, "an infancy Eden of unsurpassable beauty, but also a state completely vulnerable to terrors of separation, loss, and even fears of potential annihilation. Unquote. Solomon also refers to Dr. D.W. Winnicott's description of a baby as an immature being who is all the time on the brink of unthinkable anxiety, an anxiety kept at bay only by the mother's validation of the infant's existence. To recall infantile bliss is to reawaken that infantile terror, which is what happens in those Mozartian mood swings. And the music becomes an act of reparation, a security guaranteed, and the archaic anxieties are stilled by this incorporation into the formal beauty of the piece. Can this be true? It sounds great to me, and it certainly helps fuse my passions for Mozart and William Blake and the preeminent work of all the songs of innocence and experience. Now, I want to relate some anecdotes concerning children that have permanently colored my view of human nature. when I was in England some years ago, I have children's theater, the Night Kitchen Children's Theater, and we were planning to do a production of our version of Peter Pan. In order to get the rights to do Peter Pan, J.M. Barrie left the rights to the play to the hospital at Great Ormond Street in London, very famous hospital that Dickens and all the Victorian writers contributed to, well known. And they have profited from the royalties all this time. It was a magnificent gift. So in order for me and my colleague Arthur Yorings to get those rights, I had to visit and talk to the people there. And while I was there, they wondered if I'd like to see some of the children. And I didn't know what I was getting into because they took me to the cancer ward for small children. And it's like a beehive of rooms. There's the hospital room with a child, and then there's a little side room which is fixed out for making tea, sitting, maybe sleeping over for the parents. It's like a tiny suite for each sick child. And they told me that there was one little girl who loved Wild Things, and they heard I was going to be there that day, and she brought her copy. And would I be so kind to sign it? I said, of course. They told me she was very sick, and I was a little scared. I went in the room, and there she was. She was sitting on the bed. She looked about 10 to 12, maybe. And she had pigtails and glasses and a hospital dress. And her mother was sitting there next to her on the bed. And her mother was very appreciative. And, oh, you're so kind. And, oh, this means so much. And I said, I noticed the little girl was very impassive, very impassive. And I came in, and I introduced myself. She nodded. I held out my hand. She didn't take it. She had the book in her lap, and her mother patted the bed next to her daughter and said, why don't you sit here? So there's the girl, me, and the mom. And hard to make conversation. So you say stupid things like we all do to children. I'm so glad you like my book. And she shrugged like, who told you that? Now, I knew she had been enthusiastic. I knew she was very excited about this, but she absolutely could not show it or admit to it. And so I said, finally, would you like me to sign your book? Again, shrug. Whatever was the look. And then her mother was very embarrassed. I don't remember the girl's name. She said, honey, Mr. Sender came in. Don't be rude. Give him the book. Okay. And she passed the book to my lap and looking. I said, would you like me to draw anything special? You have a favorite Wild Thing? Nothing. So I started to draw very slowly and so that she would be drawn in. I was making a big fuss about the drawing. So she did. She began to relent. And she leaned in on me slightly. And then she started to laugh. Good sign. And then when she saw more of the drawing emerge, she said, are you sure you illustrated this book? She said, that doesn't look like a good wow thing. I said, well, you want to help? You want to try? She said, well, okay. And she took it and started to draw it, and I started to draw on it. And now she's laughing, and she has very slowly slid closer to that one hip is on my leg, and she's leaning comfortably on my shoulder. She has gradually made it into the relationship, and we're laughing. And I look this way, and there's Mom, and she's smiling, smiling, smiling. She's so happy that her daughter is acting decently. And now we're laughing, and she's asking me, why did I do this, and why is he doing that? And then gradually, she has her arm around my neck. And I'm acting very cool. But then I notice out of the corner of my eye something that is very terrible, which is that her mother cannot control crying. Because obviously the picture she saw was the artist, her very young daughter, who is going to die, having this scene, memorizing it, and it's cutting her alive. I couldn't do anything, so I took my eyes away from the mother, and I went back to the girl. She's here, I'm here. And then I noticed that while we're laughing and talking, the arm that was around my shoulder suddenly falls away, and it crawls across the bed to her mother's arm, and then down onto her mother's hand, and she clasped it tight. And I felt that this child was comforting the mother for something this child knew was inevitable. And the other side of her was laughing and joking with me. And I don't know how to end this story. When Iona Opie and I first met in London in 1989, we were about to embark on a book together, and we soon discovered that we were delighted with each other. I will announce that I am in love with Iona Opie. I had all but given up on a publishing life, not out of indifference, but for all the reasons I've already mentioned. My love and respect for Iona rejuvenated me. Our book, I Saw Esau, is a demented grab bag of foul-mouthed fun and games. Tough English kids, city-gritty kids, adorable and insolent. I felt at home in that book and remains one of my special favorites. Like the prodigal son, I am now back at work illustrating a picture book and designing one last opera, both of them named Brundabar. The picture book, written by Tony Kushner, is based on the opera Brundabar, an opera meant for an audience of children and designed to be sung and acted by children. It was performed 55 times by the young inmates of the Terezin concentration camp, where many of the most important Czech intellectuals, painters, and musicians were trapped. Among them was the young composer Hans Krause, who wrote the music for Brundabar. News of the mass murders committed by the Germans was spreading worldwide, and in a grotesque effort to stifle these rumors, Hitler had the camp spiffied up and then invited the International Red Cross to come in and showtime. The last scene of the Nazi propaganda film entitled The Führer Presents the Jews with a City captures the children of Terezin singing the jubilant finale of the opera. They were all exterminated, of course. These two Brundabar projects have occupied me for some few years now, and they have brought me full circle to my uneasy childhood, to the dead relatives I never knew, to all the murdered Jews who haunted my childhood. I'm ready for them now, not so vulnerable, not so weepy and scared. Over the years, everything in my creative life has gradually been strengthened and newly fashioned. Of course, I cannot understand how that happens, but I believe my life's journey with Shakespeare and Keats and Melville and Blake and Mozart and Dickinson have resulted in what Keats fervently referred to as soul-making, a process that comes about only through an intense observation of life and the use of the brain and the heart as a kind of chapbook to record our experiences. I cannot exclude the experience of Mickey Mouse, King Kong, the Dionne quintuplets, Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers, Charlie Lindbergh Jr., or the Holocaust from my chapbook. All of it cooked to a savory chicken soup that nourishes me and lifts my spirits. Keats lived only 25 years, and he knew all this. It has taken me 2 months short of 75 years to begin to figure it out. I'm not complaining. I am strangely content. Perhaps I am even finding my way out of limbo. Only time will tell. I want to end with this quote from a letter written by J.R. Ackerley to Stephen Spender. Quote, "To speak the truth, I think that people ought to be upset. And if I had a paper, I would upset them all the time. I think that life is so important and in its workings so upsetting that nobody should be spared, but that it should be rammed down their throats from morning to night, and may those who cannot take it die of it." One last thing. A while ago, I mentioned that there was something more to be said about the painting Christ's Descent into Limbo, which had been on loan to the Metropolitan Museum from the collection of Barbara Johnson. Coincidentally, as I was putting this very talk together, I read the following headline on the arts page of the New York Times: Mantegna Mystery. And the article went on, "Two telephone bidders at Sotheby's yesterday morning tried to buy Descent into Limbo, the last painting by the Italian Renaissance master Andrea Mantegna that is still in private hands. George Wachter, director of old master paintings for Sotheby's worldwide, took the winning bid for $28.5 million, just shy of the work's $30 million high estimate. All Sotheby's would say is that the buyer wished to remain anonymous." Wait a minute here. Who cares who paid all those billions? Doesn't everybody realize by now that this painting belongs to me? Thank you.
You've been listening to Cambridge Forum, sponsored by the Lowell Institute, the First Parish in Cambridge, and the Friends of Cambridge Forum. For a CD or audio cassette of this program featuring author Maurice Sendak, recorded in April 2003, send a check or money order for $12 to Cambridge Forum, 3 Church Street, Cambridge, Massachusetts, 02138, or visit us on the web at cambridgeforum.org. In Cambridge, Massachusetts, I'm Jamie Paglia. Thank you for joining us.